You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have David McIlvaney with me once again. David is the president of the McIlvaney Financial Companies, McIlvaney Wealth Management, and ICA, a precious metals brokerage firm. And, well, he's been with us a number of times in the past, so I'm not going to read his whole bio, but you can catch that on our website, or better yet, to learn more about David and all the things that take place under the McIlvaney umbrella. Go to McIlvaneyICA.com. I think that's a good place to start anyway. Thanks for joining me again, David.
As always, great to be with you again.
It's always good to have you with me. We've titled our show today, Living and Investing in a Dystopian Digital Currency World. And I sort of picked up on that topic in part from your weekly podcast, which I listened to last week. Digital currency, how close do you think we are to... Well, we have digital currency now for sure, but how close do you think we are to seeing regular currency, paper money outlawed?
Yeah, I think one of the great ironies is going to be this notion of a utopian digital currency world turning dystopian, where everything that was promised in terms of freedoms, flexibility, and frankly, privacy and opacity all of a sudden gets turned into a bit of a control freak's nightmare. And I'm the dystopian aspect, I think, is where we're going. It's not where we're at today. And one of the things I mentioned in last week's McIlvaney Weekly Commentary was that the central bank digital currency launched by the Chinese here in the last several weeks is really the template for other central banks to follow. And, you know, they want the ability to effectively implement monetary policy, and digital currency gives them a few tools they've never had before, or actually it takes the old tools and just sharpens them. So a lot there. But, yeah, I think dystopians is an accurate description.
Hmm. To what extent do you think this pandemic has sort of accelerated this process?
Well, as someone once said, crisis compresses time, and perhaps we would have gotten here, but on a longer time frame. And what we have now is an openness, not only because of the development of cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and Ethereum and Ripple and others, but also just seeing that the digital universe is a universe that we're comfortably existing in. What are we recording on today for this show? How do we do our Zoom calls if not in the office space? So this notion that whether it's digital commerce, digital communications, there's just a greater ease with the whole ecosystem. And the idea that cash being a burden, to your first point and your first question, physical cash is going the way of the dodo bird. And it's something that I think central banks would like to get rid of. They've wanted to for some time and just haven't been able to. Now you look at what was experimented with in India a year or so ago, removal of their currency and a move towards the digital under the guise of financial inclusion. That's a fancy euphemism for let's take care of the little people. Of course, we should all understand at this point that when the government says I'm here to help, you should run from the room with your hair on fire. But nevertheless, that's what happened in India. That's what is happening in China today with their digital currency. And Jerome Powell has said, we don't need to be the first. We just need to make sure we get it right. And so, yes, we'll have our own version of a digital currency. And bad news there is that, I mean, for all the good news of convenience and things like that, the bad news is it does mean that we're moving towards a closed financial system with all that entails.
And what might be some of the things that it entails? Give us some idea of how that might be hurtful to our freedom and our liberties.
I had a conversation with Carmen Reinhart, who at the time was professor at Harvard, and she described it as corralling investors. And once what, you know, like so many cattle, once they're corralled, you can direct and control them. And so the closing of the financial system is really giving investors what in philosophy might be called the fallacy of false alternative. You can choose A or you can choose B, but that is all you can choose from. And so you choose whatever you like, as long as it's A or B. And so that idea of guiding or herding or corralling is really important for monetary policy implementation, because let's say, for instance, people don't like the idea that their savings are being inflated away, and they decide that they want to exit, quote unquote, exit the system. But that's not option A or option B. That's option C, D, E, or F, and those aren't open to you anymore. So the value for a central planner of closing the financial system is that you get to more effectively operate with the fallacy of false alternative and determine the course that you consider best for the economy. As a freedom-loving American, that kind of grates me the wrong way. But it's very efficient. The Chinese have experimented with it. There's a little less freedom there than there is here, so perhaps there's a little less social pushback. I'm hoping that we aren't just interested in convenience here in the U.S., but notions of freedom and liberty still prevail.
They do, and I happened to watch Kyle Bass speak this morning on CNBC, and he was warning about what the Chinese are doing, and he's fearful that we may be lumped in or sucked into that system or something like that, and really is hoping that we will resist. But it occurred to me as you were speaking that maybe this the government and the central banks have just solved their financing issues, their financing requirements for trillions upon trillions of dollars that are being created out of thin air, to the extent they can't continue to create endless amounts of money from nothing. They might just get us to help them pay for it. And we'll have that choice A or B, I guess, maybe. Be limited to that.
Yeah, we're all familiar with inflation as a tool. And, you know, if you go back to John Maynard Keynes, one of the things that he was sort of set to accomplish was getting capital out of capitalism. He described it as destruction of the rentier class. And that basically meant if you had extra savings, quote-unquote capital, and could put them to work for your benefit, maybe it was a rental property or something like that, he would consider that idle capital and dead money, and he wanted every dollar circulating through the system. And so what we are moving towards in sort of a top-down managed financial system, and if Kyle Bass is concerned about that sort of the temptation to manage from the top down, learning from the Chinese and applying it here in the United States, friend of ours, Russell Napier, used to say, if you want to anticipate the future, you ought to study Eastern Europe. You'll learn a lot about what's coming our direction from a public policy standpoint. But this notion of closing the financial system, you've got inflation as sort of the right hook, and then the uppercut comes from financial repression. And financial repression is holding interest rates at a very low level and basically extracting value from a savings base a different way. And this is the beauty, I've put that in quotes, but the beauty of the closed financial system and being digital is that you can attach a sell-by date to the digital currency, and it forces the money that would have been, again, in Keynes's view, dead capital or the ridiculous capital of the rentier class, it forces it into the system. Because here's the carrot and stick. You get to spend it today, or it's worth less tomorrow. And how much less? Well, again, that's determined by the central planners. Maybe it's worth 2 cents less. Maybe it's worth 25 cents less. Maybe it's worth 50% less. But the motivation is to get that money into the financial system and see that there is an increase in velocity where that money's turning around. Bases a lot of effectiveness on an assumption that we know what's best for other people. And again, this is one of those things that's annoying to me, I think to you too.
Oh, for sure.
The notion of a top-down managed system takes individual rights and individual decision out of the picture and says, we can determine for you because we're smarter. We've got better education. We've got the experience. We're just that kind of group. It's like the pigs and animal farm.
Yeah, it is very concerning, for sure. It is the antithesis of what our founding fathers had willed for us and fought for us to give us, this idea of the individual being important and being sovereign, and the government here to serve us rather than the other way around. But we are now being vassals of the state. I guess we are being asked to serve the elite more and more. It would seem that way in any event. So if you're only given a limited number of options, then what can you do, David? I mean, we still have some options now. Is there anything we can do now to try to prepare for this dystopian future?
I think one of the things you have to do is reconsider the traditional mix of 60-40, 60% stocks, 40% bonds, or depending on your age and demography, maybe switch it the other way around. Bonds will become what they once were called, certificates of confiscation. And so that part of the portfolio is no longer a place to go for safety. I grant you, in a snap second, in a deflationary moment where a particular asset class is circling the drain, people may want to own bonds instead of something else. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about a long road here, not a short-term event. A long road where you're talking about major capital destruction in the bond market. I think you want to own real things. The way we've positioned our asset management company is to own four categories of real things: precious metals mining companies, global natural resource companies, infrastructure where there's a hard asset with a cash flow attached to it, and specialty real estate is the fourth category that we're interested in. And again, it's a real thing with cash flow attached to it. Two of the four are cyclical, two of the four are non-cyclical. And then we manage the risk according to the cyclical nature of the commodities in question, if we're talking global natural resources and precious metals, because there's times to own those things and there's times to not own them because of their very violent volatility. But nevertheless, the four categories make up real assets, tangible, hard assets. And we think in a period of central bank experimentation, monetary largesse, this is a better approach. It's a better approach to gaining income, which is absolutely necessary, and it's a better approach to preserving value and even positioning yourself for growth.
Mm-hmm. What was the second category, David? I didn't catch it.
We have precious metals stocks, global natural resources,
okay,
and then infrastructure and specialty real estate.
And then looking for some of, I would imagine with the precious metals mining companies, you're probably producers and not so much exploration companies.
Precisely. And the main reason for that is, again, with more of an income focus, what we learned from the South African mining shares in the 1970s is that when they're making money as producers, there's also generally healthy dividends to receive. And we're already seeing that with the majors. So given the fact that our investor expectation is both for conservative growth, appreciation and income, the income component's more important. There's no doubt that there's opportunity with an exploration company. It just doesn't fit the profile that most of our investors are looking for. So we were right, positioned as we are with a decent cost basis and precious metals miners, the producers, there's some pretty attractive dividend yields.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly I'm focused on the little guys that are finding the deposits that those big producers are looking for. That's another exciting area, but certainly doesn't have the cash flow, that's for sure. And real estate, David, are you looking at probably REITs or real estate investment companies that produce cash flow and pay good dividends?
Yeah, I mean, we're definitely looking for anything publicly traded. So REITs mm-hmm. is the space that we frequent most. And especially real estate put us in good stead even this last year, where a lot of rents did not get paid. If you were in an apartment or particular retail type properties, those are of course no interest to us. But logistics, storage facilities, cold storage, there's a variety of ways to approach the real estate market, which are just different. And, we got to focus on very high quality credit. And our worst case scenario last year was a REIT that collected, I think its worst quarter was 98% of its rents.
Oh,
so Yeah, even in the midst of one of the worst crises in modern history, global pandemic, we had an accurate appraisal on both the credit risk and the portfolio quality that is necessary to kind of walk through a tough patch.
If I'm remembering correctly, the last time we spoke, you were not so concerned about the demise of the dollar. Alistair MacLeod, who we have on frequently, is. That seems to be a major theme of his. I don't think you were that concerned about inflation. Are you more so now?
I think we're always concerned about inflation, mm-hmm. probably not hyperinflation. Mm-hmm. And we're definitely concerned about the demise of the dollar, just not as a cataclysmic one-off event.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
It's something that is happening in front of us. It's one of the reasons why I was very interested to see the development of the digital currency in China, because one of the things that we have lacked, and I would say from last conversation to this, perhaps one of the shifts is this very issue. You go back to The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, a book that was written in the 1960s, mm-hmm. and the thesis is basically that a paradigm does not change, a worldview does not change, until the anomalies and the problems of that worldview are better solved by a new paradigm. Uh-huh. And what we've had is problems with the dollar for a long time. Uh-huh. The dollar paradigm, the monetary system based on the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency, is problematic, period, full stop. And you can say, okay, well, because of this, that, and the other, it's going to end. Yes, but what's the alternative? What's the replacement? Mm-hmm. And for some time, it was thought the euro might be that. But you look at the dysfunction there, and a friend of ours used to call it the Frankenstein monster, as in the French franc and the German Stein, kind of a play on words. Uh-huh. And it is. It's a currency Frankenstein. And it's very dysfunctional. It's not going to replace the U.S. dollar. But it may be that the digital yuan or RMB is a replacement. And so that's what I'm most interested. Yes, I am concerned about the demise of the dollar, but only on a time frame where the problems which are apparent with our currency can be addressed by a new alternative.
Mm-hmm. As long as that alternative doesn't completely put us, lock us in our homes or in a jail cell forever, I suppose. But but you need to look on the positive side, David, and you certainly, I think, keep things in the proper perspective, and I'm grateful to you for that. But what about, I think I heard you talking about cash. I didn't hear you mention. Do you keep some cash in your portfolio? What sort of cash reserves do you have for a rainy day? I mean, let's say that the interest rates get out of, let's say the Fed loses control of the rates and the dollar starts to lose its, you know, it's that people just don't have confidence anymore and they dump it. Or at some turning point when there is this new system that comes into play. Interest rates start to spike and go through the roof. Is that a danger that you see? I mean, we're seeing higher rates. Recently, we've seen higher rates. Michael Oliver, who was with us a little while ago, thinks that treasuries and gold will go in the same direction here for a while until it breaks apart. But do you see the need at this? I mean, my own sense of feeling is that I should have more cash than I have in my. I just feel very uncomfortable about this stock market right now. And I know you do too, because I heard some of your remarks last week. But what are your thoughts about how should you have some cash around right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you look at the bond market and you look at interest rates, there's a lot of risk that's underestimated there. Mm-hmm. And yes, I think rates can go considerably higher, driven by market forces and dynamics in contrast to what the Fed and other central banks would want in terms of a direction lower. There's this issue of being in cash and being concerned about devaluation, and yet that is an issue which is a slow burn issue, mm-hmm. versus what you addressed as a real fast burn issue of mm-hmm. volatility in the stock market. Mm-hmm. Stock market can lose between 10 and 15% in three sessions. Mm-hmm. It might lose 50% over a six-week period of time. And our current inflation, at even the worst case, 50% is going to take you decades to get there. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, which is better, which is worse. They're both less than ideal, but I'd rather be in cash than in equities today. Mm-hmm. And even with the positions that we have, we've moderated those and are not at full allocations. We've been as high as 50% cash. We're currently closer to 30%, but we feel like we've got plenty of dry powder to add to existing positions. Very strong businesses, strong assets being developed, and very solid balance sheets. Nevertheless, prices can suffer greatly, and so we have cash opportunistically, defensively, and we just have to sit with the tension of not having every dollar invested. It comes at a cost. We know that. Mm-hmm. But we recognize the cost on the fast burn issue, market volatility, mm-hmm. as being far greater.
Yeah, maybe you could just share with our listeners some of the signals that you talked about of a bubble nearing its end. You talked a little bit about that on your last podcast.
Gosh, there are so many different signals. I mean, if you wanted to look at things from the standpoint of how investors are engaging in the market today, you know, everyone knows the term risk on versus risk off. Risk on is when you're pretty enthusiastic about prices going higher. And today we've got that measured by margin debt. Not only are people willing to bet 100% of their money, but they're willing to borrow money from the house and bet even more. So $814 billion was the last number on margin debt, highest we've ever seen. And, that comes from the Q4 Z1 report. You can look at broker-dealer loans as another indication of incredible leverage in the marketplace. Look at what happened to Archegos, this family office. Yeah. is not leveraged with margin debt, but they've set up derivative contracts with a number of prime brokers. And, you know, it's a guy who very effectively turned $200 million into close to a $20 billion personal fortune, and, you know, took his winnings as a hedge fund manager, the original $200 million stake, turns it into $20 billion. But guess what happens when leverage positions move against you? He's done and closes up shop in a week. It's all gone. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, how do you lose $20 billion in a week? well, we just got to see it. And so, again, what does that suggest? It suggests that there is a tremendous amount of leverage in the system. We could look at the SPACs, that phenomenon yeah. of special purpose acquisition vehicles. Mm-hmm. That would be another example where, you know, there's been 288 SPACs that have gone public just this year, raising $94 billion. That's up from – and that's just in a quarter.
Yeah.
That's up from last year's total take in terms of the IPOs related to special purpose acquisition companies, $83 billion. So from 83 last year, 94 in the first quarter of this year, and last year's number was six times what it was in 2019. This is remarkable. It's really yeah. remarkable.
David, we just have a couple of minutes left. I'd like you just to tell our listeners again about some of the services that you provide under the McIlvany umbrella. You have ICA, which is I think of as a coin company, as a company that sells precious metals. But you're more than that, and I think you even provide an opportunity for people to have their portfolios assessed or looked at. Am I right about that?
That's right. I mean, from beginning to end, whether it's a precious metals portfolio or an equity portfolio, bond portfolio, my specialty when I worked with Morgan Stanley years ago was with municipal bonds. So we're happy to look at it and give you a second opinion on just about everything. Mm-hmm. Precious metals business, my parents started in 1972. It's expanded to be a full-fledged brokerage company relating to gold ownership in every form. One of the most unique tools that we offer for investors, and I would encourage your listeners to look at vaulted.com, mm-hmm. V-A-U-L-T-E-D, vaulted.com. It's a great way to save and have an alternative banking program or savings program mm-hmm. Denominated in gold. And that I think is very innovative and helpful. We have a unique tax structure as it relates to that particular product. So something that frankly nobody else in the world offers. The asset management company we mentioned earlier is kind of a complementary thing. Think of us as kind of the ideal football team. You've got the offensive coordinator looking at the hard asset strategies in the four categories we talked about earlier, where growth and income are the priority. And then the defensive coordinator is where we're putting together an insurance-type portfolio invested in gold, silver, and the platinum group metals. And we look at those very opportunistically to be able to trade the ratios between the metals and gain in ounces, even when the prices aren't necessarily moving to your favor. So a very productive way to approach the metals. We've got 5 decades experience doing that.
All right. And I think it's possible also to put some gold in your IRA through your services as well, right?
Yeah. In fact, going back to the 80s when they allowed that, we were the first company to do so. So kind of groundbreaking in that regard. Yep. MacroVision.com is a great way to follow us. Or weeklycommentary.com if you want to listen into our thoughts each week.
Excellent. Thank you very much, David. That is it. That's all the time we have, unfortunately. But thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with us. Greatly appreciated. And we'll look to do it again sometime, hopefully, in the near future. All right. Thank you so much. Well, that is it for this week, folks. Next week, I'm going to talk to John Rubino. Dr. Quentin Henning will be with me again to talk about SK Mining. Really some exciting things taking place there. Maybe a surprise guest or two. Well, until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Firefox Gold is actively exploring in Finland, where recent discoveries have sparked a new gold rush. Firefox controls a major portion of a prospective gold belt, giving the company a distinct advantage for exploration and strategic partnerships. The company's strong international leadership team, combined with its Finland-based exploration specialists, will put Firefox on the crest of the coming wave of gold discoveries. Firefox Gold trades on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol FFOX. Go to firefoxgold.com to subscribe for updates.